Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics, with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Christian has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big step. Oh!
What a lead, Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan, open, Chicago with the lead!
Hello and welcome back to the Over and Back NBA podcast on thepodiumgame.com. We're a member of the HP Basketball Network. I'm Jason Mann, and with me as always is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yeah, it's been too long, too damn long since we've done this. So I'm excited, especially this subject. I'm very pumped about this particular subject.
You're cursing, so I know you're excited.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know. Are we explicit? I don't know if we have the explicit rating on iTunes.
It'll be okay. I think maybe a few dams here are not going to throw the whole game off. But
not throwing any F-bombs out.
No,
here.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that. So what are we going to talk about today?
Oh, we're talking Detlef Schrempf.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite NBA Jam players,
woo.
Which we will talk about a little bit later. Yeah, this is one that I don't even know how we came about it, but Detlef Schrempf.
Yeah, likes. You know, I mean, why not? There doesn't really need to be an excuse for Detlef Schrempf. I mean, he's obviously just a huge groundbreaker. One of the real, one of the first European players to have any type of success in the NBA, probably after Sven Nader. I think started that wave, or was kind of part of the start of that wave that brought a lot of European players into the game in the 90s and 2000s. Of course, Tony Kukoc being another key one, Dirk Nowitzki, of course, being the greatest European player, I think it's fair to say, in NBA history.
Yeah, that's pretty... Yeah, I'm trying to think if there would be any... Who would be the next best contender if you were...
That is an excellent question that I had not.
Yeah, I wonder. I think it would be Dirk. Yeah, just bouncing off the top of my head. Maybe we have to do a separate show on that. But
sure.
We'll
come back to that.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, I'm racking my brain now, and it's completely unrelated to what we're.
So he was a three-time All-Star in 2016 season. Played very effectively into his late 30s. He was a member one all NBA team, the third team in 95 season. Two-time sixth man of the year. He grew from a role player in Dallas in some interesting late 80s Dallas Mavericks team. Became a super sixth man in Indiana on some of the early Reggie Miller teams before they kind of really, had their success. And then most famously became, regular all-star level player in Seattle, part of a strong group with Sean Kemp and Gary Payton and Hersey Hawkins and other guys, he was definitely, a key cog there for some, very strong teams, including one that made the finals.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the way we sort of broke this down, too. I think it's perfect, too, because it's sort of the way I think of his career as well. Is we broke it down. We're going to talk, Dallas and then Indiana and then Seattle and Portland. It's those sort of, four teams, but I feel like two separate eras of Detlef Schrempf as well. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the first half of his career, he was very good, but I don't know how important he was. And then later in the second half of his career, he also became a very, a really key player for some really good teams. So we're going to, we got a lot to talk about, so we'll hit back to it. We want to first talk a little bit about, just kind of give some props to some people who have been doing cool stuff, either for us or sharing stuff or what have you. So I want to, we've had some...
Apparently people listen to this. I'm shocked.
Well, yeah. We like people listen to it. I mean, we're not quite that shocked, but at least I'm not, So I have confidence in us. I don't want to get caught.
Well, no, I'm more shocked that people are like that they listen to, not just tolerate us and like be like, I'll just listen to this crap or whatever, that they're actually going to interact with it and say, hey, I listened to this episode and here is a fun note about this. You know, like they don't listen to the first 3 minutes of it. You know what I mean? They're like, hey, you mentioned this in like the 90th minute of this show or whatever. It's cool. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that we can run long, so I can understand people need to you know, either take an intermission in between or, you know, maybe not always listen to the whole thing. I get it, but anyway, we want to thank Mark Roberts, who gave us some really cool links to some uniform research on, you know, we talked about NBA jerseys of 1999 in our last show. Also passed along a few articles related to Detlef that helped us in our research. Also wanted to give props to Raphael Canton, who runs the NBA Trades Tumblr, which is definitely
so good.
Yeah, it's a great site. It really, really breaks down some, you know, the trades, talking about, you know, the before and after, and, you know, really getting into some really great research. So he's awesome. More people should follow him and be linking to his work because it's really good. So nbatrades.tumblr.com, I believe, is the site. You can follow him on Twitter as well. We'll have links to it at the bottom of the show notes. And then also just a guy who's Matthew Kovac, who's been sharing some cool photos, not just with us, but with, you know, Curtis Harris and, you know, different people who are, you know, really interested in NBA history, kind of related to some of the subjects in our show or subjects we've mentioned on Twitter. So that's really neat to just see.
I'm just honored to be a part of that mention group. He's like, hey, I'm sending this to Pro Hoops History, and over and back. It's like, ooh, okay.
Absolutely.
Like
that
means a lot.
So
that really
we're into that. And Curtis, of course, who's been on our show a couple times, has also just said nice things about us on the internet, which has helped us grow our audience a little bit and made people, you know, mistakenly respect us. So we appreciate that. So props to these people. So we're going to take a little break, and then we are going to chat about the beginning of Detlef Schrempf's time in the United States.
The Dallas Mavericks select Detlef Schrempf of the University of Washington.
Detlef Schrempf has come to the dance. Ready to party. Look at that. He definitely wins Best Dressed Award thus far, although Patrick Ewing was looking pretty spiffy when he was selected first. Detlef Schrempf, the University of Washington, 6'9", 220 pounds, played his club basketball in Germany, played at Centralia Washington High School a little bit, but he is a West German youngster. That's where he was born. How good is he as an open floor player, coach?
I think he's a great player. The person that he reminds me of is right here with us today, Rick Barry. I saw him play. We played in Western Regional, and I had an opportunity to see him play, and I definitely thought that he reminded me an awful lot of Rick. He can score outside, he can score inside, he runs the floor well, and he defends reasonably well. So I definitely liken him to Rick Barry.
All right, and we're back here on the Over and Back podcast talking Detlef Schrempf. And now let's begin with his early life, even before the NBA career, his growing up in West Germany. We talked about at the top of the show of him being a European player. I did a little bit of quick research. The second one is really tough. That might have to be a listener comment on that. Of like, cause there's obviously a Dirk guy, and then there's so many other guys I saw in a second. There's like a Vladi, and, you know, Pejas, and you know, Detlef as well. I think you can maybe even make a case for him as well. So there's a lot of really interesting ones. But no, obviously born in West Germany. He played soccer until he was 13. He got an argument with a junior national coach and then quit the team. Do we know what started this argument?
I don't know the specifics of it. I just did that. Was basically just kind of the background. It's like, oh, he quit the team. I know basketball was kind of rising in West Germany during that time. Yeah. He met former UCLA center John Ecker, who was coaching a basketball team there, and sparked his interest. I guess, you know, he quickly became good enough that you know, he's like, well, if I'm really going to make it, I need to go to the United States. So he ended up as a high school senior enrolling in Centralia High School in Washington, and then won a basketball title there, then was recruited by Washington, won Pac-10 titles in 84 and 85. He played guard, forward, and center, so he's a very versatile player. You know, and demonstrated, you know, so many skills that he had. I mean, just the great passing for his size, being, you know, I'm not sure if this is so much in college, but later on, you know, just became very effective from the three-point line. Actually, I'm not sure. Was it a three-point line in, when he was in that? I feel like that 87 sounds
in
right to
college.
Me. In college.
Let me, like yeah, when later. Was the... Yeah, when was the college three-point line? Let me find out for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, he had the skill, you know, just to attack off the dribble, posting up versus small forwards. I mean, he displayed that multi-versatile, you know, starting in college, but obviously going on later. He also played with a fellow West German, Christian Welp, who it's spelled Welp, which is one of my favorite NBA names. He didn't last long in the NBA, but he was a Pac-10 Freshman of the Year when Detlef was on the team. Another guy who was kind of an important, you know, West German import.
Sorry, not to interrupt. 86-87 was the official introduction for all college basketball. There were some conferences that did it before, but that 86-87 was everybody's got it.
Okay,
now,
so. We don't know for sure if he was a great three-point shooter in college, but he became one fairly quickly. So the other key kind of West German player during that time was from Indiana, Uwe Blob, another great name who and then would later be his teammate on Dallas, although he did not last long in the NBA as well. So another thing worth noting is that he played for West Germany in the 84 Olympics and also the 83 and 85 Eurobasket, in which in 85, West Germany actually won the Eurobasket there. So,
yep.
And his wife, Mary, was a former hurdler on the West German Olympic team. And there was kind of a good SI article sort of on the rise of the West Germans and Detlef himself, you know, with kind of some interesting tidbits in it. He was called the White Magic for his ball handling. He said that he loved Magic and Dr. J, thinks he can play guard and loves to pass, maybe even a little bit too much. And then the other kind of interesting note about it is that talking about the crowds that sort of chant Nazi at him, and he said they seem a little childish, but they don't bother me. So I guess he had a decent attitude about dealing with that. And then
one thing before we move on, I want to talk. It was kind of interesting as well. And we'll see this a little bit more. I thought that SI article that you're talking about where he says that he thought he could play guard and he loves to pass and that sort of stuff. And we saw that in his career. And that's something that if you watch Detlef Schrempf, you know, videos or you're familiar with him, you know that that's a guy who and you hear it in the commentary anytime you're watching these videos that he's 6'10 and passes like a guard. He kind of moves like a guard. He doesn't. I mean, he backs down like a forward, but pretty much every other part of his game, it seems to be sort of guard play. He was, and that's been a kind of a theme with a lot of the Europeans that come in, that they sort of have this ability to be tall, but also, you know, where America was developing a lot of the big men in a way where they would just back down. They were big behemoths and that sort of stuff. Whereas Europe, you got a lot of these guys, and he was one of the first who came in and was multi-talented. He could do a bunch of different stuff. We saw it later with Sabonis, and we always heard that with Sabonis as well, that if he came, you know, 10 years earlier, he would have blown the doors off the NBA, but obviously we got the not so good Sabonis. But no, I thought Detlef was particularly interesting. Yeah. And I thought that quote was exactly, you know, what we saw later in his life when he, you know, would love to play guard, love to pass, you know, good shooter, that sort of stuff. So very interesting.
Yeah. He ended up being picked eighth in the 85 NBA draft, which was the infamous or famous Patrick Ewing draft, the first lottery draft. And he definitely, rates highly among the players who are there. He's third in win shares per 48 to Karl Malone and Sabonis, and then fourth in total win shares to Malone, Patrick Ewing, and Terry Porter. So
yeah, so nice company.
Yeah, Terry Porter's it's kind of a surprise to be that high on there. I mean, I thought he was a good player, but yeah.
That could be. I wonder about his raw numbers, because Porter played a lot of years, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that left it too, but
yeah. I mean, yeah. No. To be fair, let me see. 22-38. Yeah. No. I mean, hey, you got to be good to get put that many as well. But yeah, Porter was surprising.
His win shares 48 were right. You know, they were not. They were just a little bit lower than Detlef. So
sure. So he wasn't just accumulating, you know, win shares over a course of a year. He had he had a few years. I'm looking here just really quick. Yeah, early 90s with Portland, obviously. You know, over 10 win shares in you know, three consecutive years and then nine in another. So, Oh, crap. So we had 5 years of above nine win shares. Yeah. So yeah. Okay. Have at it, Terry Porter.
It's absolutely. Absolutely. So, and you know, the Mavericks are sort of definitely a team on the rise. You know, they've got Mark Aguirre, who's, you know, kind of their star. Well, I guess next to Rolando Blackman, James Donaldson, who's a pretty strong center. They have a young Derek Harper, a young Sam, very young. Sam Perkins. They actually, Bill Weddington is a rookie. He's not really an important player for them, but he's there. You know, I mean, they really.
His three games started, whereas 56 games. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, there you go. So
it's hard to imagine Bill Weddington as a young player. You know what I mean?
Right. He just seemed
like, because when he was on the Bulls, he just, even if he was like 30, he just seemed like he was like, like 38, like no matter what, like yeah. That's a guy who's just perpetually been like, I just can't imagine seeing a 22-year-old Bill Weddington, but yeah.
So they in the 86 season were 44-38. They were second in league in offense, 21st in defense. They made their third straight playoff appearance, their third season with a mid-40s win total, and they fell in the second round to the Lakers 4-2. So, you know, have to feel decent about that result. He was ninth on the team in minutes in 969, not in the year 1969. And also, Dick Motta was the Dallas Mavericks coach, good old crusty Dick Motta. And he also sported, well, I guess what you might call an interesting mustache during that time. We did have some mustache-related tweets going on. I mean, asking us to delve deeply, of course, into the great mustache.
It's a superior mustache. Let's.
Yeah, it's a little.
I don't know if it's quite as good as the Larry Bird stash, but it's heavy. It's a very heavy mustache for me.
It is. Coming a little bit perilously close to a Chaplin mustache, which is obviously a little bit of, it can be a problem if you're German, but you know, I think he looks better without the mustache, but it's a respectable effort. I'm willing to give it some points.
Yeah, it's not bad. It curves a little early, which is kind of odd. He definitely upgraded by getting rid of it.
I agree. I'm not sure exactly when he busted out the flat top.
That's what I was trying. I'm trying to look through pictures here to kind of see here. I mean, obviously it was early Pacers, but I can't find a picture of him in a Pacers uniform without the flat top. But was he flat top with the Mavs at any point?
Did he have a? I don't think he did with the Mavs, but I know he did with the. I haven't seen pictures of it with the Mavs, but I know he did with the Pacers. So
yeah, that's all I found is every Pacers picture I see, he has the flat top. So it must have been in between that year. Maybe that was a. We'll talk about it a little bit. The repressed. He was depressed about, or no, not depressed, rather encouraged by the move. So he decided to go to the ridiculous flat top. And there's those early Pacers years. It's like a flat top, but it's also really long in the back.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a flat top mullet because.
Well, you know, there's a you know, business up front party in the back. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, that's essential.
So I can still confirm. Yeah. No Mavericks pictures with the flat top and no Pacers pictures without it.
All right.
So.
Well, if anyone can actually track down the mullet.
Pinpoint, I want the day.
Yeah. If possible, the day that he went to the flat top, we would greatly appreciate it. So
thank you. Yes.
So next is 86-87. The Mavs improved to 55-27. They're in the middle of the league as far as defense goes. Second seed, it's looking good for them, but then they are upset by the 39-win Sonics, who were led by Dale Ellis, who had been traded from the Mavericks to the Sonics, I think partly to make room for Detlef, you know.
Yeah.
So, and Ellis just kind of went crazy. That's, I mean, he had hit 29.5 points, you know, 8 rebounds, shooting 56% from the floor, you know, 50% from 3-point range. So that's a pretty good series.
Yeah, but getting his minutes almost doubled, as you mentioned, Detlef rather, getting his minutes doubled is sort of leads to the, as you said, yeah, Dale Ellis, you know, removed to give a little bit more room for Detlef. Sure. It certainly seems that way without knowing, you know, the exact background.
During the reading that was mentioned specifically, like, you know, that he was traded for that reason. So, and then there's a sort of another feature. This is before that playoff series, but during like December of 86, so early in that season, talking about how, you know, the Mavs are rising, and there was kind of some interesting thoughts at the time, kind of just the difference between white and black players. Like, it was weird. It was considered weird by the writer, I guess, that Schrempf kind of played like a stereotypically like a they say an inner city player. I guess it's a quote. But
is there a way around of saying black?
This is from a quote. So being from Germany, he never heard how white guys were supposed to play. So he emulated the players he liked, Dr. J and Magic. There's also talk about how he listened to rap music at the time, like that was also sort of like thought of as like a novelty, like he listened to, you know, quote, like black music, which is just, you know, funny today because, of course, you know, hip-hop and R&B are the most popular music genres and pretty right. much everyone listens to, but at the time it was, I guess, considered more of a novelty. So I just thought that was just sort of an interesting
crazy white guy. I like that he didn't play how white people were supposed to play,
right? Exactly. You know, well, I think that may have been, that quote may have been a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but still,
yeah, but it's
just something obviously that no one would say today, you know. So so you want to talk a little bit about the next season?
Yeah, absolutely. So 87-88, again, this is another really successful year here, 53-29, and this is the first year with Suns coach. John, is it McLean? McLeod? I can never
I think it's
pronounce.
McLeod.
That's, yeah, I hate those ones that are, why? You know what I mean? Do you hate, because the Cubs general manager is Jason McLeod or whatever, and it's spelled the same way. Why is that McLeod?
Yeah. I don't
MAC capital LEOD McLeod.
I don't know. Maybe the guy with the last name of Krejci isn't the one who
to throw around.
Yes,
get your last name figured out, guys. All right, but no, obviously this is the they were third seed this year, so they fell a seed, but we're still, you know, super successful with 53 wins. They beat the sixth seeded Rockets and then the second seeded Nuggets, and then again, unfortunately, fell in seven games to the Lakers. Detlef, surprisingly, though, did not play in Game 7.
Yeah, I think, you know, they'd like tighten the rotation in that game. I think they're like, mm-hmm. like seven players for Dallas played in that game, and he was the...
That was like an all-hands-on-deck. We're just
guy,
like,
right, yeah.
Yeah, you guys are just going to die.
And they were, were a deep team. By then, they had Tarpley, who was awesome until drugs got him. You know, the rest of the guys were all kind of between 26 and 28, you know, the top players. So they were just, you know, all these guys who were right at the right age and, you know, were really great. So I can understand, you know, maybe I can understand the decision, you know, without like looking at the game film and going back into every single detail, but I can see kind of where, you know, he's just on such a deep team and he's still fairly young and, you know, maybe is a guy where it's hard for the thinking of the time for him to quite like fit into the team. Mm-hmm. Maybe in that kind of situation, but,
and that game seven, I'm looking at the box score right now. It was like an all hands on deck sort of deal. I mean, Brad Davis is the only guy who, played less than 30 minutes and he played seven and he shot one time.
Right.
So,
exactly, yeah.
And he's even a really good player on that team as well. He's still an important player on that team, but yeah, it was basically Derek Harper, Blackman, Aguirre, Donaldson, Perkins, and Tarpley were the only ones that played, and they played over 30 minutes and Harper played 46. So
yeah. And that was
we're not trusting anybody else besides the guys we know for sure. Cause this is a must win for the,
yeah, there was the second of the back-to-back Laker title years, and they went through, they had to beat every single opponent in seven games to win that title. I'm trying to remember if they beat the Pistons in seven too. They had to go through all the early rounds. Yeah, I think they did. They had to go to the Pistons in seven as well. So that's certainly a, nice. You know, a tough road for them, but they were able to, make it through. Donaldson and Kareem had some great battles in the inside. I mean, there's a LA Times article kind of talks about the series a little bit. And then in game seven, Magic demanded to defend Tarpley to keep him off the boards, which is just interesting. I mean, just shows like what a tremendous player Magic was, that he would
do that. Cause I'm going to be the guy to stop him from rebounding Kareem.
Right. Know? Well, because Tarpley had 20 multiple games with 20 rebounds in that series. So, and then Detlef is sixth on the team again in minutes this year. And 18.3 minutes a game per game in the playoffs. So,
and we talked about this Mavericks team a little bit, I think, in our Jersey podcast. But they're a very interesting team that I don't know if enough people kind of look at or give credit to. Because as you mentioned, there's a few, you know, we talked about a few series here. And in this one in particular, I mean, they're one game away you know, being to an NBA Finals, and we just sort of think of them as an afterthought in the 80s. Like, I really don't know if enough people, especially because a lot of people in my generation, we grew up and they were just a laughingstock, you know, in the early 90s, and it looked like this team had never been good, but they had been a really good, them and the Bucks are some of the two more interesting teams of the 80s for me, just teams that never quite got there and really just kind of get lost in history in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and they collapsed very quickly, which I think is part of, I mean, but, you know, if they had won Game 7 and made it to the finals, even if they had lost in the finals, they'd be thought,
yeah, it doesn't matter,
they would be
yeah.
thought of completely differently, you know.
Sure,
any
exactly,
team that
right.
makes the finals automatically has that cachet, even if they're not particularly a good team, you know. You made the finals, so, you know, you're now the winner is obviously remembered more than the loser, but, you know, but you're still, you know, you have that finals run.
It's,
that
yeah, it's more of an accomplishment in a lot of ways, where you know, people always say, you know, you need those titles or whatever, but getting a guy to, you know, people always mention that too. Well, he got them to the finals or whatever. You know, like an Allen Iverson is not really, yeah, it would have been great if he won it, but I think people give him enough credit just for getting there in a lot of ways. And I think these teams in general, the Bucks and the Mavericks, especially the Mavericks, would have been thought of a lot different just getting there. Even if they got pummeled and even if they lost in four games, that would have been fine, but they would have been a really interesting matchup with the Pistons that year too. I'd be very, very, I wish I could had a time machine to go back and see that, but
absolutely. You know, the next year that, you know, kind of all just falls apart for the Mavericks. There's a great post from the NBA Trades Tumblr blog that I mentioned, where you know, basically they got off to a pretty strong start at 17-9, then they lost seven in a row to start off 89. James Donaldson, who's their starting center, had been hurt. Tarpley was dealing with some drug issues. And then big one is that Mark Aguirre was just hated by everybody on the team. And there's an SI article that details that in detail, because Detlef was traded February 21st, 89. And then Aguirre was traded like right, or, you know, almost exactly the same time for Adrian Dantley, which is, you know, kind of a famous, it's a famous trade because of the perception that Isaiah forced Dantley out and got his buddy Aguirre in. And of course, afterward, the Pistons did win their two titles after failing the year before. So, you know, the perception of that deal is interesting, but Detlef was traded for along with a second round pick, which ended up being Antonio Davis for Herb Williams, who was a kind of an aging center who'd had a pretty long, you know, decent career.
Yeah.
And so then he was shifted to the Pacers, and the Pacers were an even bigger mess than the Mavericks that year. They had they started off with Jack Ramsey, who was 0-7, then had Mel Daniels, who was 0-2, George Irvine, who was 6-14, and finally Dick Versace, who does better at 22-31. And
jeez.
Once they
has that ever, I mean, I don't know if anybody knows or if you know offhand, any other team that had four coaches in one year? There's three. I get the, like, the interim coach deal. I see three a lot, but four? Like,
yeah, I feel like I've seen it maybe in one of those Jazz teams of the late 70s, but, you know, I'd have to.
And ABA teams do not count.
Right,
by the way.
Exactly. Yeah.
I am not counting ABA teams. That's where their checks bounced and the coach was like, no.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy being paid. No, so, NBA. I don't want ABA.
Yeah.
No, NBA.
The Pacers were 11-40 when Detlef joined, but then actually ended up being 17-14. Was given a bigger role. His minutes jumped from 22.8 to 31.4, and basically at this point kind of had evolved from slightly above average to very good player.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he definitely embraced it. You can tell that, you know, going from a winner to a loser, or sort of a winner, I guess. I mean, he could probably see the writing on the wall with that team. But to go into that and going to a team that, you know, as you mentioned, 11-40 and under a lot of turmoil, though. But he's still, you can tell from just looking at the numbers, the box scores, the game scores, he embraced that. He knew he was getting a bigger role and really made the most of it, because we're going to find out, you know, the next year just how good he was able to be, you know, when given the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the 90 Pacers are the next season. He's fourth on the team in minutes. They also have Reggie Miller, who's leading the team. And Reggie, you know, the funny thing about Reggie is it actually kind of took him a while to sort of be perceived as a star. Like, he didn't get it. He had one All-Star berth actually in the 1990 season. Didn't even have another one until 95, which is kind of, I know that position was loaded, but that's sort of crazy to have happened. And they also had Chuck Person, Rick Smits, who was in his second season, LaSalle Thompson, who was a Longtime big man, and I believe he's in our Twitter background, isn't that right?
I believe so. Yes,
with Kareem and
Chuck Person's a guy that I in doing research for this, I never realized how good he was for his little run with Indiana.
Yeah,
he's a good player.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of considered. Yeah, I think he and Reggie were kind of neck and neck stars on that team. So, but over the next four seasons, it's funny because the Pacers finished with 42, 41, 40, and 41 wins and lost in the first round every year.
That's NBA hell right there.
Yeah, right. I guess it's probably they could have like not made the playoffs. I guess that would have been worse.
But then you get a better draft pick.
Well, yeah.
That's why it's NBA hell to just be good enough to.
Right, but stay. I mean, would you rather have, I mean, that's the difference between the 15th and the 14th or whatever. You know, I mean, that's not a huge difference, I guess. But yeah, so I mean, the big problem with the Pacers during that year is that their defense was just always pretty bad. I mean, they were like 24th, 26th, 19th, and 21st in defense in those 3 years. That they traded, or I think the first couple seasons they had Dick Versace as coach, and then Bob Hill took over in 91 and was there for a couple of seasons before they brought Larry Brown in, and things changed quite a bit. But Detlef, he averaged 17 points, 8.6 rebounds, and 4.1 assists per game. Shot 51% on field goals and 81% on free throws in Indiana in 354 games, which is pretty good.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely turned himself into a good little player. Won a few six man of the year award as well.
Yeah, won it in 91. He beat Dan Majerle by one vote, and then won it the next year as well. And the funny thing, yeah, they would also the Pacers would dig themselves into holes quite a bit. Like they would just keep, like, for whatever reason, they would start off poorly and then we'd get better throughout the season and then would end up with, you know, nearly .500 record, and then of course would lose in the playoffs. But they lost to the Pistons, they lost to the Celtics, and they lost the Celtics twice, and then lost to the Knicks. So they did take the Celtics to 5-91. That was, I guess, probably the best of the teams that they had. That year was, I guess, Game 5 was known for best for Larry Bird falling on his head, becoming unconscious, and then eventually returning to lead Boston to victory, which was kind of like one of the last Magic, you know, Bird moments.
Yeah, yeah. As well, I was watching the video on this one as well. He definitely has a concussion. They're just kind of like, well, whatever, just get it back out there. Yeah, but it's
put
fine.
Some dust on it, you know.
Yeah, the old days, the good old days where.
Yeah. Player safety wasn't
just important. Shake the cobwebs out, kid.
Exactly.
You're good. Just like, okay. But no, that was a fun game, too. And that's, I know, watching the video of that one, too, you see Chuck Person just being a beast in that series as well.
Yeah. And Bird had trouble pronouncing Detlef's name. It would be Deltliff, which is just like the
close enough.
That's the Larry Bird, you know, that I.
He's the Hick from French Lick. Yeah. Close enough. Come on.
There you go. In 92, he, you know, has another strong year again, the sixth man year follow up. But then in 92, he wants to be traded. He's 4 seasons into a 10-year deal after the Pacers refused to rework his contract. Donnie Walsh is the Pacers GM at the time, it was just kind of basically like he feels like he's being taken advantage of, and Walsh is like, well, you know, he's still making okay money, and, you know, we are over the cap, so too bad. So, I guess it ended up being worked out because he ended up being a free agent after the 94 season, I believe, so. So,
and that was, I think this came up in the Pippen podcast too, but we can maybe look that up. Something happened around this time as well. Didn't they get a new TV deal? Because this was the same, I think, I'd have to look it up exactly, but I'd have to go back to the Pippen one. I wonder I think this is the same time when Pippen started getting really weird about, because he signed a long-term deal after, I think, the 90, was it this one? Was it the 91-92 season that he started getting weird about his contract? Because I think that they signed a new TV deal, and then
it was,
you know,
there was
a ton more money, and other people were getting signed, and then these people that had signed right before that were like, you know, can I get more money? And the other guys were like, no, you know, to the owners, you know, for their side of the argument, like, no, I'm not just going to give you money just because you asked about it. But yeah, to be a free agent, though, that was probably a better idea for him in the long run.
Right.
So.
And they had a couple of short lockouts in 95 and 96, which were kind of related to that. And of course, the big one in 99, where kind of everything, you know, we have basically the structure that we have today because of the 99 lockout. So, and he plays for a now unified Germany in the 92 Olympics. They made the 8-man tournament, but they lost in the first round, and they lost, 111-68 to U.S. during group play. So they did okay, but no one was beating the Dream Team that year, obviously. So.
No, yeah, that was gonna be tough. Yeah, that score is actually probably not pretty bad. That's a victory,
right? For the Unified Germany. Exactly. Yes. Well,
they didn't lose by 80,
we'll count it as a victory for Germany.
Yeah, that's chalk
officially,
that one off.
Officially a victory. So,
yes.
93 season. He actually statistically had his best season. He made the 93 All-Star team. I guess he started 60 games because the Pacers traded a Chuck Person for Sam Mitchell. So. So basically, he no longer was eligible for the sixth man of the year. Otherwise, he probably would have won it again. But he had a great season. But they hired Larry Brown as a coach, and Indiana's philosophy sort of changed more under defense. So a trade is going to happen near the beginning of the next season. That's going to change. Both franchises' fortunes, so I think we'll get into that when we talk a bit about the Sonics. So I think we're going to take a little break and talk about some other things and then go back to Detlef's career.
For the Sonics, McMillan, Perkins from the bench with Payton, Detlef Schrempf, and Sean Kemp, 26-10 with 4:20 remaining in the first quarter. Perkins going low to Schrempf against Ori. And Detlef Schrempf, who's had a terrific series and led the Sonics with 21 in game two, had 10 rebounds as well, brings Seattle to within 14 again.
All right, and we're back. We're taking a little bit of a break from Detlef's career to talk about sort of a related topic. And one interesting thing that I sort of figured out with the Mavericks, the 1988 Mavericks, they were a one and done conference final team, which basically means they only made the conference finals one time with basically the same team that they had. And I sort of wondered how rare that was. So I sort of did some research and looked into, I looked at all the teams since 84, since that's when basically the modern playoff system, happened. And actually it's more common than I expected it to be, but it's still, I think it's interesting sort of these are all, I think all these teams are like, they kind of raised the question of like, how much potential did they have? Or like any of these cases, if these teams had won these series, what would we think of them today? So the first is the Phoenix Suns of 84, who lost in six games. They had kind of a lot of older guys, Walter Davis, Maurice Lucas, James Edwards was actually fairly young, of course, of later Pistons fame, Alvin Adams and Paul Westphal. And
yeah, not coaching Paul Westphal.
playing
with
right,
Paul
that was his
Westphal,
last season. Larry Nance was kind of their other young star, and they took the Lakers, to six games that year. Now, because actually the Suns made it to the conference finals again in 89 and 90, and then of course to the finals in 93. But those 89 Suns had a completely different roster than the 84, which I'm sure that's not that rare, but that just seemed like, wow, 5 years to have your team completely turn over and to be that successful again that fast. That part of it's probably pretty rare. So
absolutely, no, certainly, yeah, that was, yeah, but you can't count them as another, because it's just they're not the same.
You're
in a five-year gap.
Exactly. So I feel like that doesn't count. So
because you look at these other teams, just really briefly, like looking at like the 2001 Bucks to like the 2006 Bucks, it's like total change in roster, but they were no good for a while.
Exactly.
It took them. They still have not gotten to that level yet. And a lot of these teams we're going to list have really had a lot of issues getting back to that level, 5 years out. And then the Suns go, from one, completely different core to another and are successful with it. So it's definitely, very rare, I would say.
Absolutely. So the Nuggets of 85, they lost to the Lakers again in five games. They had Alex English, Calvin Natt, Elson Turner, Dan Issel kind of toward the end of his career, and Fat Lever. The 87 Sonics lost to the Lakers in four games. They had Xavier McDaniel, Tom Chambers, Dale Ellis, Eddie Johnson, Maurice Lucas, and Maurice Lucas again. And they were the team, of course, they were like the 39 win team. I guess it's very impressive that they made it all the way to the conference finals, but then they were swept by the Lakers clearly over their head, and the 87 Lakers, of course, being one of the great teams of all time. The 88 Mavericks we mentioned. And then we go to the 92 Cavs, who took the Bulls to six games. They had Mark Price, Larry Nance again, Brad Doherty, Hot Rod Williams, Craig Elo, and a young Terrell Brandon. So that was...
So the key to winning the NBA Finals or making the NBA Finals is don't employ Larry Nance or Maurice Lucas. Yeah. Is clearly, as we found out for the first five teams we mentioned, the clear key is don't have either of those two, and then you'll... You'll make an NBA Finals.
I forgot to mention of the Sonics of 87 had Russ Shaney, you know, the famous, yes. The Shaney projection system.
The man who created the projection system, right?
Something like that. And then the Heat in 97 took the Bulls to five games. They had Tim Hardaway, Alonzo Mourning, Vashawn Leonard, Jamal Mashburn, Dan Marley, and P.J. Brown. I kind of forgot about Marley being on the Heat. He bounced around a lot, of course, after the Suns days. And then, as you mentioned, the Bucks of 01, that was just kind of a weird, like, oh, yeah, they were that good for, you know, a couple years. Ray Allen, Glenn Robinson, Irvin Johnson, the big center, not, of course, Magic Johnson, Sam Cassell, Tim Thomas, Lindsey Hunter, you know, a nice team. I guess that was before they had Gary Payton.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that was a really good team. There's a funny I'd have to see – I have to find it again. But I remember that team, and I remember, you know, when they lost, one of the biggest things, and all the Bucks team was complaining about it, that they thought that the NBA was being, they're making calls for Allen Iverson, or they really wanted to, which I thought was very interesting, you know, in retrospect, that Ray Allen saying, well, you know, he's their next star, so they want to, you know, do everything to cater to him. And it's funny how that would sort of turn around, you know, very quickly, and they would do everything to get away from Allen Iverson being, you know, the representable star of their league. But in that one in particular, and I'll have to find the exact quote, but I do remember that being a big talking point after, is that, you know, the Bucks felt slighted by the calls there. So
yeah, and then it happened twice in 02 with the Celtics. Antoine Walker, Paul Pierce, Kenny Anderson, Tony Batty, and Tony Delk. Of course, Kenny Anderson and Tony Delk being members of the wonderful 2004-2005 Hawks team a couple seasons later. And Antoine Walker. I'm sorry, three.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't even need to reach for that. You
didn't even lead. Yeah, I forgot to. Yeah, the most important player on that team. So, yeah, that team I don't think just was very good. That was just a really weak East. And then of course, you know, why don't you talk about it a little bit, the Kings of 2002.
Yes, yeah, that's a famous, you know, the Kings team, obviously, the Chris Webber, Mike Bibby, Divac, Bobby Jackson, Turkoglu, Christie, and Stojakovic. That one was, I always felt that they had a better, it was the next year, I think, when Chris Webber blew his knee out, correct? And I always thought that year, I could be wrong, I could be missing a year in there, but I always thought that team was a lot better than the one where Webber blew his knee out. But obviously, this one made the you know, the conference finals. I mean, famously, you probably have heard of this story as well, and the famous, you know, rigged games and all that sort of stuff. But very interesting to see the Kings here on this list. And they're a team that, you know, at the top, when you sort of introduced this and talked about teams that would be viewed differently if they had just made, you know, an NBA final. And in this case, I think the Kings, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Kings probably would have beat the Nets this year in the NBA Finals.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's one that would have been a completely different team, you know, in a different, golly knows what would happen to that market too. Cause this is one where you see where, you know, they never really quite made it there. And then slowly but surely the team started falling apart. And then the team, you know, obviously they're still in Sacramento, but, you know, under, you know, ridiculous circumstances and all that sort of stuff where it was very close that they were going to be moving and all that sort of stuff. So it's so interesting to see a team like this that was, you know, had they have made the finals and if they had won the finals, what would have changed about their history? You know, how would we perceive the Kings these days? You know, just very interesting stuff here. But yeah, that's a famous team there, the 2002 Kings. And this next team as well was a very interesting one. The 04 Timberwolves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, KG, Sprewell, Wally Zerbiak, Sam Cassell, and Trenton Hassel. Yeah. You know, I think these two, those two teams, I'd probably give the edge to the 02 Kings, but as far those, these are probably the two best teams among these on that list, although there, you know, there's some very good ones here. Yeah, you know, this was, you know, Garnett's probably his best season, just, you know, kind of rushed through and then ran into the Lakers again, and you know, unfortunately in six games. And then, you know, up until the Boston redemption in 08, you know, that was kind of like the...
His narrative.
Right, yeah. I mean, that this was the best that he had accomplished. And then, you know, they started to struggle after this. So, you know, he, but, you know, in retrospect, I mean, he played amazingly that season and even that postseason. then the Jazz of 2007, who actually – this was the year that the Warriors upset the Mavericks in the first round. That was the first 8-1 in a seven-game series, I believe. Right. And then, you know, they have Darren Williams, Boozer, Karolinko, Okor, Matt Harpering, and Derek Fisher. But they end up falling to the in front of the Spurs in five games during that season. And then the 2009 the 2009 Nuggets, who I think are kind of forgotten about. Like, I hear like a bunch of people who are like, oh, get out of the first round, Carmelo Anthony. I'm like, he made it to the conference finals one right, time. Yeah. I mean, I get it. Like, you know, he's not
a long time ago. Yeah.
Right. I mean,
memories
yeah.
are go away, but sure. yeah, I absolutely.
And they had Anthony, Chauncey Billups, Kenyon Martin, Nene, J.R. Smith, Chris Anderson, took the Lakers to six games. And then, more recently, the Bulls in 2011 who fell to the Heat, and then the Grizzlies in 2013 who fell to the Spurs. And but those teams are still, I guess, intact enough that if they yeah. could make conference finals runs this year, I wouldn't consider them one and done. You know,
certainly. And the Bulls seem like an easy pick there to sort of, especially this year, if everything, you know, goes right health wise, to be back there and sort of off this list. The Grizzlies, yeah, I mean, they still could definitely, but that'd be an interesting, they might be added to this list here in a little bit, but as far as, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, yeah, these two still pretty much intact. As far as, you know, the Bulls, you got Rose and Noah and basic stuff like that. And the Grizzlies are obviously pretty similar. I mean, you got Randolph and Gasol and the sort of guys, the Conleys and that sort of stuff. So yeah, both still intact. So I don't think we're enough years apart where we can kind of, the Bulls would be an interesting argument if you wanted to make that, because they're pretty different, but I think there's enough pieces there that are similar.
I mean, obviously Derrick Rose being the key one. So
exactly, yeah, him and Noah being the two best players,
right?
Has sort of remained. I mean, you lost Dang and a few kind of bit players and Boozer and those sort of guys, but yeah.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but I think they're similar enough where, like, I don't think even though Paul Pierce is on the 0-2 Celtics, I don't think that those team is at all similar to the 0-8 Celtics. You know,
right?
Plus,
exactly.
The Bulls still have the same coach. You know that, or well. Did they have Thibodeau in 2011?
Yeah. So that helps as well.
Yeah. Right. So, that is the list. And that's sort of an interesting, there's a lot of what ifs there, which is always a dangerous game, but a fun one too. So, good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll be back in just a moment, and we are going to talk about the second half of Detlef Schrempf's career. Detlef Schrempf, 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 Detlef Schrempf. Green monster, first found my style.
Okay, we're back on the Over and Back podcast talking the career of Detlef Schrempf, and now we're getting to the second half of his career, which Jason started off with the trade to the Sonics. And, of course, as we mentioned at the top, the NBA Trades, .tumblr.com has an amazing post on this. Just like, I just kept scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. I mean, that man is the most detailed trade breakdowner I've ever, I mean, it's awesome. And then definitely check.
In a very interesting and fascinating way, not just listing facts, but you know,
yeah, exactly, but
really
yeah.
interesting writing as well. So,
but I wanted to make a shout out, especially this one, of reading this one, you know, in the way this is sort of a trade that, in the grand scheme of things, maybe doesn't mean a whole lot for us in this research of this piece, you know, or this episode. It meant a lot to us, but the fact that much work went into, you know, a Derek McKee for Detlef Schrempf trade, that tells you all about that blog, and all you need to do is check that one out for sure. But no, this is a very interesting trade, you know, going from Indiana to the Sonics, and one that he sort of had mixed feelings about.
Yeah, well, you know, he was upset at the timing of it because it was November 1st, 93, so Rias right before the season would have started. And he said they could have done this a month ago and showed me some respect.
He talked about going to training camp and working out with the team and doing all this sort of stuff. And he said in a way that they knew I was going to be traded. They just needed to work out, you know, the paperwork or whatever. And he said that showed a lack of professionalism on their end to have him, you know, go around and do the training camp and do all that sort of stuff. And knowing full well that the trade was probably going to happen. And, you know, we don't know about that exactly, but, you know, I get a little bit of his, but you're a professional. I mean, that happens. Professional.
Yeah.
Sports, so.
I can understand both sides of that. And then some of the teammates are like Dale Davis and Reggie Miller and Sam Mitchell are all kind of like, oh, no comment. You know, there's some uneasiness in that locker room, you know, coming off.
Sam Mitchell pretty much guarantees he's next.
Right. Yeah. On the, after the Chuck Person trade, but this was definitely, you know, a turnaround trade for the Sonics were already pretty good. I mean, they had won, they had I think they came out. Yeah, they came off a Western Conference Finals run in '93, and you know, so they were already there. But I think Detlef helped, you know, shore them up a little. Yeah. Certainly.
I think this is one of the ones, and we talked about this in the show prep for this, is it's very interesting, and it's one that we don't see a ton these days, but it was one that just sort of worked for both teams. It was, you know, here, you take this guy, you take this guy. I don't think there's a way that you can say any team really came out, you know, better or worse. I think maybe, you know, maybe the Sonics a little bit because Detlef turned into a really good player, but Derek McKee helped them out as well. And, you know, the Pacers went on to have a, you know, a good run in the mid 90s. So this is one that, yeah, it's not one of those we too often now. And I think that might be created by the media too. We're always looking for winners and losers of every trade. Well, sometimes, you know, everyone's good, you know, it's just here, you take this one. Or I call them like, you know, a challenge trade of, you know, here's my good player, here's your good player. Let's swap them and see what happens. And both teams did really well.
Yeah.
So.
And the next seven seasons for the Pacers under Larry Brown and Larry Bird, you know, they're a, you know, plus 50, or they win 47, then they're a plus 50 win team pretty much every year, except for 97. They have a drop off and then the lockout year, but they're still very good those years. So that obviously, you know, helped them. And then the Sonics are, you know, a 50 or 60 plus win team up through the, you know, up until the lockout year. So. So strong for both. There definitely was some feeling of Seattle as though, like, even though Detlef would, they were glad he was there and he was respected as a player. And, you know, they didn't outright say that, but probably was considered a better player. But that there was definitely a feeling that McKee was missed in the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll kind of get to that actually pretty quickly. The 93-94 season, they win 63 games. They actually started 16-1 and were 26-3 at one point. Kendall Gill is a newcomer as well. And Shrimp is second in minutes to Gary Payton. Kemp is there. Former teammate Sam Perkins is there. Nate McMillan, and then a aging Ricky Pierce is there as well. So
he didn't cross paths with Ricky Pierce.
No, because Ricky Pierce was in Milwaukee.
Oh, right. So never mind. That's me talking the Milwaukee. Yeah, never mind. I got the Milwaukee and Dallas Mavericks mixed up because we were talking about them. Never mind.
That's all right.
Carry on. Yes.
So they are, you know, excellent. You know, they're second in offensive rating and third in defensive rating. But, you know, there's an SI piece early in the season that talks sort of a bit how much they like to fight each other. George Karl says we're crazy at times. We yell and cuss at each other, maybe a little more than most teams. Shrimp himself says this team doesn't hold anything in, but I have no problem with that. I'm pretty emotional myself. Maybe sometimes people on the scene say things they might regret later, but it's only because they're so committed to winning a title. After years in Indiana, that's something I'm glad to see.
So, sideswipe.
Yeah, I think maybe I consider that mild, but I get what you mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's looking pretty good. But there's also sort of like the question of like leadership and the question of like having the go-to guy and that sort of thing and the feeling that they didn't have it. There's a lot of questions about Payton at this point. You know, it's, you know, easy to, you know, see him as, I mean, he's obviously an all-time great and he's a Hall of Famer, but, you know, just whether he had what it took, you know, compared to some of the other great point guards in the league, like Stockton, for instance, is someone he's comparing himself a lot to quite a bit. So, and they're upset by the Nuggets in the first round, the first time in a number eight beat a number one seed, this being a 5-game series.
Yeah.
And they blew a 2-0 lead. And Detlef actually was really, like, numbers wise, he was very, very good in this series. Like, and he was the only one really of the, you know, in the series who consistently kind of played well, you know, through the whole thing. But he was, you know, just a guy who, you know, he was looking good, but the rest of the team, you know, was kind of up and down.
Yeah, Kemp in particular had a real bad, he shot 37%, 14 points per game. But yeah, Detlef led them in, I think, field goal percentage, points, you know, he had a great series, definitely. And then the rest of them, yeah, not so much, as you said, but.
Yeah, then there's sort of a breakdown of that series, basically talking about them being, the feeling that they were high strung, susceptible to pressure, that like their, you know, heavy pressure defensive system didn't necessarily work well in a long series because teams could adjust to it. And once it became a half court game, the Sonics weren't nearly as good. And also their lack of a go-to guy. So also there was a fight between Ricky Pierce and Gary Payton in game two. And then Detlef has an encounter with Brian Williams of the Nuggets, who's a character I didn't know much about, but But he's sort of an interesting, colorful in some respects, although he also dealt with some depression and some other issues so he was a little bit just, you know, volatile, you know, not obviously not by his own fault, but just, you know, the way what he was dealing with. And basically just is, you know, "I'm going to bleep you up," screamed Williams. And then Shrimp said,
"I think that was Mutombo."
Was that? Well,
I think that was Mutombo. Yeah, maybe Williams said it as well,
there's another one with Mutombo. Well, this might probably be the same incident.
I think it's the same incident. Yeah, I'd imagine encounters.
That would be
with,
right. Yeah, I guess it. Ryan yeah, Williams, it basically Shrimp like challenges him, like Williams, and says, you know, "You and who else? You bet. You know." And he took a step closer. "You better get some help." And then Williams goes berserk, and he was ejected. So it was just kind of an instance of Detlef, you know, not taking any smack from anybody. Kind of, didn't end up adding up too much since they lost that series. But you know, just sort of an interesting, you know, for the most part, a guy who seemed to. I don't know whether he was he kind of seemed like a cool guy on the court to a certain extent, but then he did have some, he called himself emotional, did have some outbursts here and there. So, you know, I guess we're all complicated people, you know? So, and then want to talk a little bit about 94, 95.
Yeah. So 94, 95, obviously 57 wins. They were the fourth seed. So they fell a little bit there, and then they fall again in the first round, this time to the Lakers. I found a few particular notes here about this team when I was doing a little bit of play indexing. They were second in offensive rating, and I wanted to kind of look, and they had a pretty decent defensive rating this year as well, but I wanted to look at teams that had similar offensive rating and similar defensive ratings. Yeah.
Rich, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think you're talking about the 93-94, because the 94-95, they were second in offensive rating and 10th in defensive rating.
Oh, sorry, no, they did fall in. No, that's correct. Yeah, no, that's because what I said is they were they were good defensive rating, or they were good offensive rating, but defensive rating slipped a little bit. But I gotcha. What I did for this play indexing, yeah, okay. No, what I did is I looked at teams that had comparable ones, both of offensive rating and defensive rating, but mainly focused on offensive rating because they were such a good offensive team this year. And I sorted it by offensive rating to see, you know, okay, so of teams that had comparable offensive rating and comparable defensive rating, you know, of those teams, you know, how did those ones do? How did the ones with the really good offenses fare? And it was pretty interesting. Five of them made the NBA Finals. Three made the Conference Finals. And then only two of them lost in the first round. And interestingly enough, they are both Detlef Schrempf teams. It's the 86-87 Mavericks. And then this, the 94, the 95 Supersonics.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Very interesting how that sort of worked there. And a little bit of finagling there, but it worked out where you basically look at teams with really good offensive ratings and pretty decent defensive ratings. Of those teams, pretty much every single one of them will make the NBA Finals.
Gotcha.
Or
okay.
The Conference Finals or something like that. Whereas the Supersonics, you know, they lost in the first round, and then the only other team that was anywhere in the same, you know, the top 10 there was the 86-87 Mavericks, and they also lost in the first round. So Detlef is a choker. I'm starting the narrative right
there
now.
There you go.
So.
There you go.
Even though he plays really well in most of these series.
Yes,
but so
even though he's,
we're going to start the narrative.
Even though
so,
he's a great player,
that's how these things
and
work.
And we like
so.
Him a lot. He's a choker. Yes.
But that's how these things work is I make it up, and then it just starts for no reason.
Absolutely.
So.
So yeah, pretty much the same team returns. They're 57-25, as you mentioned, the slippage in D, because the year before they were second in offensive rating third in defensive rating. I think I might have mentioned, but they fall. They're the fourth seed. They fall to the Lakers in the first round. I believe they took a 2-0 lead in this series too.
Oh, let me find that out for sure.
Oh,
yeah, that would
I'm
be,
sorry, a 1-0 lead. They won the first game and then lost the next three, but. And they won the first game by like 25 points, and then they lost the others by 2 points, 4 points, and 4 points. So, Nick Van Exel, Vlade Divac, and Cedric Ceballos are tough to contend with, you know.
That's a bad league.
You know, they were okay. They were,
the Sonics are better.
The Sonics should clearly have won. Yeah, they were 48-34. Yeah. So they were, the Lakers' expected win loss that year was 40-42. They way outperformed their expectation. So, Detlef made the All-Star team for the second time. I think probably this or the next season would statistically probably be his best season.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
He's right around. But he's playing at a really consistently great level, and he is, you know, at this point he's 32. So he's continuing. You know, he's not dropping off like a lot of guys do. Kind of, you know, around this time, especially guys. You know, I guess he's taller, so you know the guys who are taller kind of tend to do a little bit better. You know, the small forwards who are taller, but. and the ones who can shoot as well as he can shoot. But
this is his highest win share year as well, with 12.9. And he also led the league in offensive rating as well. So, yeah, really good year all around. Yeah, I would say I'd probably put this 94-95 probably his best. But, yeah, the next year was pretty good too. But, no, he absolutely – it wasn't a token sort of we need to give this – he earned an all-star berth for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He's a good all-star in this.
Yeah.
You know.
So you know, they're coming off 2 years of playoff disappointments, and then, you know, something has to change. They add Hersey Hawkins. Trimp actually he plays 60 games. I'm assuming he got hurt. I actually don't, not sure if I looked it up specifically, but, but they're able to kind of, you know, summon whatever will they had, because other than Hawkins, who is a big addition, they didn't really make a lot of changes, but they're able to, you know, come back and make a run to the finals. And excuse me. And there
must have been those horrible jerseys. Was this the first year of the awful jerseys?
This was the first year of the awful jerseys. Yeah.
So it's the key is maroon.
Yeah. They beat the Kings easily in the first round. They sweep the Rockets, who are the defending champions, in the semifinals, and then take the Jazz to 7. And they're interesting because there's an SI article about them winning and early in that Utah series when it seems like they're about to win it. Like I think they win the first two games of the series. I'll have to double check that, but they won the first two games of the series, and then it still goes 7. So they lost the next two, and then, or actually they were up 3-1 and they almost blew a 3-1 lead. But they were able to get past the Jazz, who of course are going to be, you know, the finals teams in the next couple seasons. But it's funny where it's sort of the SI article writes it as if it's assumed, which is funny given the Sonics playoff history.
Yeah, right.
And Shrimp says, we were spoiled children then, talking about the previous 2 years. Now we are grownups. And there's just a funny quote from George Carl about, like, just he says, I'd love the challenge of messing with Michael's head. Maybe we'll triple team him. Maybe we'll start Irvin Johnson on him. Maybe we won't guard him at all, which is just,
I like the not guarding him at all.
Yes. Now, obviously Carl's not being serious, but it's just funny. Like,
it's not a bad strategy.
That feels like, you know, like just something George Carl would say, you know?
Well, that just shows Carl being like, look, what do you, I'm sure the question was like, well, how are you going to stop Jordan? He's just like, what am I supposed to do?
Although, you know, we'll get into it. But
you found something. Yeah, you found a way.
But too late. Obviously. And there's a funny thing, follow up from SI, where talking about the end of the series, and then they're talking sort of about like good luck charms or just doing whatever. And then Detlef, like, he had some lucky underwear, but then he couldn't remember which pair it was. He said, I thought, is it the boxers or the briefs? So
can't be lucky underwear if you don't know which one to
pick. Yeah, well,
if you don't know any description of the lucky thing, it's clearly not, you know,
it can't be that lucky. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, it's psychological. So and then we get to the 1996 finals. The Bulls take a 3-0 lead. Of course, this is the year the Bulls were 72 win, you know, greatest regular season record of all time, probably the greatest team of all time. They actually took a 3-0 lead, then lost 2 before winning in game 6. And then it took until game 4 for Peyton to take the challenge of guarding Jordan. And Jordan, I mean, the big difference between the first three games, 31 points, 46% field goal shooting, 53% field goal shooting, which is absurd for Jordan, who obviously wasn't a great 3-point shooter, and then 12.3 free throw attempts per game. And then the last 6, you know, he's down more than 7 points, 23.7, down 10% in the field goal percentage, way down in 3-point field goal to 11%, and then, you know, a couple less free throws a game. So, you know, maybe if they'd have gotten Peyton on him earlier, it might have made a difference. I mean, it might have made it at least tougher. You know, again, who knows? But that's sort of an interesting subplot to that series. And that came fairly close to getting to a game 7. I mean, that series, that game, that game 6 was fairly tight till the end, if I recall correctly.
Oh, yeah, no, it was. Yeah, and I remember that series in particular, living in Chicago. People were very – I mean, it was like – you know, they're up 3-0, everyone's getting the parade route ready and all this sort of stuff. And then it's like, you know, it's 3-2 and people are getting very, I remember, especially my, you know, my parents and my dad in particular was just like, you know, this is the greatest team ever. You know, they cannot lose this. You know, they can't blow this. being, you know, the greatest team ever, especially when you're up 3-0. It was just, it was ridiculous. And even that last game, as you mentioned, you, I remember not too long ago, I went and watched the tape of the I think it's on YouTube, this entire game. And the intro was very, I mean, Bob Costas is introducing this as like, the Bulls are choking, you know, can they stop choking? Or, you know, it's something like, you know, the upstart Seattle is, you know, using their length and their destruction, their explosiveness. It was like very much painted as the old time Chicago, you know, they're getting tired. It's very long in the season, this sort of stuff. Whereas the Sonics were just getting their second win and ready to go. It's very interesting to see that. And you know, they ended up winning by, I think, 12, the Bulls won the final game, but still, yeah, it was very, I remember it was very tight. People were a little worried.
Yeah. And Curtis Harris, ProHoopsHistory.com, mentions in a great post on Detlef on the series being notable for both teams, you know, having prominent foreign players, Detlef, of course, and then the Bulls having Tony Kukoc. And, you know, and I'm sure that probably, you know, was a key kind of stepping stone for more European and more international players just making their way into the league. And then after that, you know, we go into 97, and then the Sonics are still very good, but they never quite reach, you know, they obviously don't make the finals again in 97. They end up falling in the second round to
the Rockets.
Rockets, right?
Rockets.
Yeah, with Charles Barkley now on the team. So, and another terrible uniform catastrophe, of course.
The battle of the worst uniforms, and Houston won. So.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean,
Detlef makes the All-Star team for the last time at age 34. Another game where he only played 61 games that year. Most seasons he played, you know, close to, you know, 80 games. There are only a couple years where he didn't do that. So, you know, obviously being healthy is definitely great for being a good basketball player. And then 97-98, they sort of make a jump again to 61-21. They actually trade Sean Kemp. They add Vin Baker, and they actually improve. And Dale Ellis came back.
Yes, again, yes, we need
Dale Ellis.
We
had,
need Dale Ellis.
Dale Ellis had 1,900 minutes at age 37, which is
that's not bad. Yeah, and you talked about this for the previous year as well, but it seemed that Seattle's strategy for you know getting better. In the previous year and in a little ways this year was just to get older and get a lot more old. Like the next year the year that we just talked about, the prior year, they brought in like Craig Elo, and like he's like 36 or 37 at this point. And there's just a bunch of, I mean, just an old team. They got old in a hurry, but the Baker trade helped you know, get a little bit of youth in there as well. But a lot of guys over 30 on this team.
I mean, guys who are over 34 are Detlef, Sam Perkins, David Wingate's 33, Craig Elo, Terry Cummings, and Nolan's 32, you know, kind of short. They also have Eric Snow there, who's 23. He always seemed old to me. So.
Yeah, he's got an old man face. Right. Yeah, Eric Snow is a man who was born looking like he was like 33 years old.
Yeah,
so.
And then the 98 season, Evan Baker comes in, and before he has his issues with substance abuse. Jim McElvain also came in the previous couple years. Greg Anthony was thrown in there as well. So, you know, yeah, just kind of had some looks. Another great regular season team, but they win the first round against Minnesota, but it goes to five games. I wonder what the record was of that Minnesota team. Because they couldn't have been.
Let's see here. Let's fire it up. Yeah, that could not have been a very good team. Oh wow, the 45-37.
Oh, okay, so they were okay.
Who's this team? What is this? Is this a Gugliotta led team or?
They Garnett.
Oh, this is Garnett. Okay, no, this is the Garnett. Okay, no,
and
this
Marbury.
This is the Garnett Marbury Gugliotta team. Okay, they were
that was
okay
pretty
team.
Good, yeah.
And Cherokee Parks was probably the key.
I think he was. Absolutely.
And whoever DeJuan Wheat is, but.
Hey, he's got the last name of Wheat, so I'll take that.
Who the hell's DeJuan Wheat?
I don't remember DeJuan Wheat. I'm sure there's somebody listening who knows DeJuan Wheat.
Okay, he played 2 years. He played for Minnesota, he played for Vancouver, and then he said, I am done. I have had enough of this NBA.
Yeah. Or more likely, the NBA had enough of.
So no. Only $5 to sponsor
the
DeJuan Wheat's baseball reference page if you'd like
The NBA was like 15 years ahead of the time and going wheat free.
Yes, gluten free. It's also the Stanley Roberts years as well.
Yeah, which is.
Is his 1 year with Minnesota. So he's always an interesting character to look at.
Which isn't.
Very odd career for one Stanley, but.
I don't know what to say to that. I'm sorry.
No, he's a guy that he's like a potential guy. Everybody sort of thought he was going to be a lot better, and just never really ever. He had some weird issues in college and all that sort of stuff. We'll get to it when we do the Stanley Roberts.
Okay, podcast, I mean, I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, that one I'll learn a lot because I honestly don't know a whole lot about. I'm afraid to say. So, okay, well. 98, they fought the Lakers 4-1, and this is of course now Shaq and Kobe are there. Although Eddie Jones is still, you know, Kobe's still playing he only played 30 minutes in the series, so he's not playing a whole lot yet. Eddie Jones, Nick Van Exel, Robert Horry, Rick Fox, Derek Fisher, you know, all those guys are kind of playing more. And probably they just didn't have much of an answer for Shaq, who averaged, you know, 30 points and 9.6 rebounds in 4 blocks during the series. So that's pretty good. Detlef was second on the team in points, and you know he looks like he did pretty well. He shot well, didn't shoot great from three, but did everything else pretty well. So. You know, just again, another, I don't know, the whole George Karl thing is probably a bigger discussion than we have time for now, right. But I do wonder, just food for thought. I do wonder if George Karl's problem is more that he underachieves in the postseason, or if he overachieves in the regular season.
Yeah, that's I've always been in the mindset, because I love Carl. I think he's a great coach. I think he overachieves in the regular season, and then when you know, kind of push comes to shove in the playoffs, where the games get tighter, the rotations get smaller, because I think he really excels, and you can see that even with the most recent Nuggets teams, he excels in making, or at least getting a team where they're so deep that they will just run you out in the regular season, because they can go 10 deep or whatever. They can go, you know, because that Nuggets team, when they traded Carmelo and got, you know, this, you know, package of, you know, 5 or 6 guys that were rotation players, you could just instantly, I mean, that's perfect for George Karl, for him to just, you know, I'm sure he was salivating at that thought of running a huge rotation. That's always been my thought, is I think he's more of a guy that overachieves in the regular season and then has these gaudy records, and then he gets to the playoffs, and maybe these teams aren't as good as they really are, as he made them. But I can see you making an argument the other way. I've always thought of the latter, though, of him being, you know, sort of a guy that just overachieved in the regular season. But
yeah,
I'll listen to the argument otherwise.
Yeah, I'd like someone to at some point, like, make the, like, looking at all of his postseason seasons and looking at whether, you know, how many times really he came out of a series that he should have won. I mean, that mm-hmm. definitely happened.
And it could be a pace issue as well, because his teams do play pretty fast, and that's always been sort of the another thing as well, is, you know, playing in the playoffs, you kind of have to slow it down a little bit, and how do you, you know,
yeah.
how do you work well when you have to do that? And his teams kind of are based on that, you know, not, you know, the Don Nelson style frenetic pace, but a high pace for sure.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think there's I think a lot of people assume, though, that George Karl just has, you know, is just a bad coach in the playoffs. And I think it's probably more complicated, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
99 season, the lockout year, they're 25-25, do not make the playoffs. Paul Westphal is their coach. Detlef still performing well, slips very little in the season, plays all 50 games, which I guess, you know, impressive at that age and in dealing with that schedule and all that good stuff. So, definitely impressive stuff. There's a quote from a Denver Post article at the end of the season. I guess after it would have been during the playoffs, but after Seattle was done with their season, he was on the verge of becoming a free agent. He just says that offense, defense, commitment, attitude, work ethic, just clicking off the reasons why he wanted out of Seattle. I'm not saying everything is bad, but there are so many things that are not right, not the way they should be. Maybe they are just little things, but all added up. They are depressing. So he was not happy to go.
Emo.
Yes. Well, you know, the Germans are known for occasionally being a bit sullen. Yes. So, so he signs with the Blazers, who just have, of course, a cavalcade of old stars. We talked about this in the Scottie Pippen podcast, but if you didn't hear that, just some of the key ones are, of course, Rasheed Wallace, who is 25, so young, but Scottie Pippen joins the team. He's 34. Steve Smith joins the team at age 30. Damon Stoudemire's kind of the other young guy. There's Sabonis in there, who's 35. And then Greg Anthony and Brian mm-hmm. Grant, who's 27.
Stacey Augmund's pretty old at this point.
Yeah,
as well.
He's 31. Bonzi Wells is there as well. They went 9 guys who played quite a bit. Jermaine O'Neal at 21 was, you know, not playing a whole lot, but was still kind of part of that. So, yeah, but they definitely, I mean, they did have some youth there too, but they definitely have like a just a lot of guys who, you know, need playing time, essentially.
A lot of guys, yes. Yeah. And we found that out, too. That was one of the big, you know, criticisms of that year is, and Dunleavy talked about it as well, is head coach Mike Dunleavy, is that just people wanted to play. And, you know, when you have a team that's, you know, 10 deep in guys that, you know, deserve playing time, you know, those guys are going to want playing time. So, yeah, it was it seems like a good idea on paper to bring this, like, as you said, like the cavalcade of old stars and good players. And on paper, this always reads like one of like the best teams ever, but it just doesn't work in principle. It just doesn't, when it actually happens, it doesn't work. But you just look at that and you're like, yeah, nice. I mean, they did well. They did well.
Yeah, so. It doesn't work in one game from making the NBA Finals and probably winning the series. That is a different definition of doesn't work than, say, like the 2014 Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay.
So, but or the yeah, that's probably the best example. So yeah, and then they Detlef, his minutes drop, there's a slight decline in his play at 37. He was a little bit upset because when he signed he thought he was going to be the starter, and then they added Scottie Pippen, who he said, you know, I'm not going to lie and say I'm cool with it, you know, he said. I mean, probably understood, although Schrempf honestly probably was better than Pippen at this point.
Yeah, Pippen had checked out mentally and physically. So right. That's yeah. He I'll give it to Schrempf. He probably would have been a better asset there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Pippen was obviously important, but you know, but yeah, exactly. So, there's sort of a story about earlier them in the season where Mike Dunleavy, to convey the message that whining won't be tolerated, he brought a pacifier to one of Portland's first practices. So I'm sure that went over well.
Oh boy.
So that leads.
That'll get a locker room together, especially a locker room of veterans that probably don't want to take your shit.
Right. So exactly. And sort of the guys who are young are kind of, you know, known malcontents as well. So
yeah, right. Yeah, I'm sure that set the stage for a lot of good. I don't know what happened to the Portland Trailblazers in the years after, but I'm sure it all went well. So.
Exactly.
I'll just assume that everything went well.
Assume they won multiple championships and everyone was happy. Right, yeah. So his last season was the 0-1 season. He's he only plays 26 games, only 11 minutes per game in the playoffs. Then there's a Pacers.com interview with him. He just talks about being plagued by a lingering neck injury that he wanted to retire during the offseason, but he was under contract and they asked him to return. So he did so for 26 games. That last year when I had to go back and play in Portland, I wasn't really excited about that. It says it just wasn't a good situation. So,
and this was the year that Kemp came in, Rod Strickland came in.
Right.
They got older. They found a way to get older.
Yeah. Yeah, because they traded Jermaine O'Neal for
Dale Davis. Right. Yeah. So we needed to get this 21-year-old out of here and get this 31-year-old guy.
Yeah, Trader Bob was their So yeah, you kind of see what they're doing, but yeah, Dale Davis one, that's kind of Jermaine O'Neal one, that's sort of obvious, seems obvious, I guess, in retrospect, but whatever. So he's done with his career and you know, obviously had a very successful career. There's a good post on him in the from the Painted Area, for which is just was an awesome NBA blog that really isn't updated anymore, but I really enjoyed it. And talking about, you know, kind of like what to do with European Hall of Fame candidates and Detlef in particular, just kind of the idea, like he was a groundbreaker, one of the first to have any type of success in the NBA, and kind of the idea that, okay, maybe he'd be a Hall of Famer if he'd stayed in Europe, because the guys who stayed in Europe, you know, are definitely in. And someone like Kukoc, who played a lot of his career in Europe and then, you know, had some strong NBA years, is in. Like, you know, Detlef is maybe being punished because he didn't play enough in Europe, but like because of a trend center, you could, you know, it's just a weird.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, I would.
Yeah, because it's weird that maybe that we're sort of punishing him. Sort of to your point, that you're punishing him a little bit. Had he had stayed in Europe for a few years and maybe dominated and scored, you know, 25 points per game in Europe, he would be considered, you know, a great European player. Versus coming to the NBA, sort of cutting his teeth there. You know, not struggling, but not being, you know, an everyday player, a high volume scorer, a high volume player, and sort of working his way up. So it sort of punished him in that way, which I don't know if that's necessarily fair. Because I mean, he came in and didn't have any learning pains and really didn't have any struggle. I mean, he came in and was pretty good from the beginning.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, he was, and that kind of leads me to like sort of another thought of like, you know, is it more valuable to be kind of like a guy who's like has like 15 very good years and is, you know, pretty steady. I mean, has some peaks and valleys, obviously, but for the most part is like very good for his entire career. Or do you, is a guy being great for 7 or 8 years and then not really being very good or not lasting, you know, particularly long after that? Like, which is more valuable, which means more, which, you know, which weighs more? And I think it obviously depends on an individual, but I think, you know, Detlef is just a guy who just had that, like, you know, that consistency for most of his career and that very good, you know, career. And I think it's interesting to kind of consider the value of that versus, like, Bernard King's the first guy who comes to mind. If, like, Bernard King had some, like, 3 or 4 really great all-star seasons and then was kind of good, you know, here and there, and then had some injuries and some stuff. He just, and Bernard King's obviously in the Hall of Fame, and Detlef isn't. I don't know if he's really all that likely to get in to the pro basketball one anyway, but it just, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting.
It is interesting, yeah, and he's an interesting fellow because, I mean, you look at Detlef rather. You look really, I mean, honestly, of a what I would call a truly bad year. I mean, there's his first and his last are the really ones, and I wouldn't even call his first year really a bad one. The last year, yeah, I mean, he barely played at that point, but yeah, he's a very interesting one where, yeah, he doesn't get the same sort of glitz and glamour because he was just, he was just good for that long period of time, and it's a very interesting question. Yeah, Bernard King is a very. I mean, he's one that you sort of look at of, yeah, being spectacular for a few years clearly is better than just being a solid rock for, you know, as many years as you do. But yeah, Detlef's an interesting one, and we'll get to it in a little bit, but I did some advanced stats looking at him, and a lot of it could just be him piling up numbers and piling up figures, but he's a guy that statistically rates pretty well all time, so we'll get to that in a little bit, though.
Yeah, sure. We just want to talk about some of the interesting stuff he did his post-career. He started a foundation, which, you know, sounds...
He unfortunately reserved Detlef.com, which I tried to do many times in my early years, but it's a great, I mean... it's so easy. Somebody should have just done that. I don't know what.
Yeah, the Detlef Shrimp Foundation, which, you know, sounds like it does some really wonderful things in Washington, probably other places. There was a song written called Detlef Shrimp by Band of Horses, which is, you know, a nice. It's melancholy, but it's a nice. It's a nice tune. I dig it.
We're gonna go out with that. I think we're gonna go out with that song.
Fair enough.
We got it right.
Yeah, I think it's important. And then he made multiple appearances on the TV show Parks and Rec, which
it does awesome in him. He's really funny in those.
Yeah, like, well, yeah.
He's so dry and, like, weird, but it's so perfect for Detlef Shrimp. They make me laugh so much. Well, it's probably just because I know who he is. And, like, I think, like, my girlfriend, when she watches, she's like, that wasn't that funny. I'm like, no, but it's Detlef Shrimp. And, you know, then that conversation just goes nowhere.
I think he's good. There was a... I listened to a podcast recently with a writer from Parks and Rec. It was a Zach Lowe podcast where he talked to
a writer from
Parks and Rec and talk about what, you know, good acting and good comedic timing that Detlef had. So I think it's strong.
Certainly more than Roy Hibbert. Hibbert has his appearances in that show too, and they're funny just because it's Roy Hibbert, but it's, you can tell the difference between Detlef, who kind of gets it, and Roy Hibbert too, just like,
yeah.
Is Roy Hibbert just kind of like, hey, what do you want me to do? And like, like it's very different. But Roy does a good job too. I laughed during his parts as well.
Yeah. Detlef seems like he's an active guy and does a whole lot of cool stuff and has managed to kind of keep his name out there and as far as I know, has never really had, you know, any trouble. You know, it hasn't had like the post-playing career that some guys do where they can't, you know, stay out of the news or out of, you know, issue stuff. He just seems to like have a good life and good for him if that's true.
Absolutely. We got some questions as well. Do you want me to run down a few of them?
Yeah, sure.
All right. This one is great. And I think we do need to definitely discuss this, and maybe we can get Curtis. I don't know if he put this together, but I'm sure someone did. Rich Thomas at EarthDog asks, is Detlef Shrimp in the NBA Haircut Hall of Fame? So we'll have to ask Curtis if he curated that as well.
Yeah, well, it definitely would have to be like in the non-Afro division.
Sure. Because there's wing. The Afros are a wing. Yeah, that's not fair to rank anybody with. No, Artis Gilmore cannot be ranked with any other human being. Like, he needs to be in his own, like, world. So
exactly. I mean, yeah, he's...
it's spectacular. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he made the flat top work, even though it's, you know, it's not like my... you know, not my favorite haircut, but yeah, he definitely, you know, he made it work for him. So I think it belongs there. Absolutely.
We have Joe Hall Repin. It's at Joe Hall Repin as well on Twitter. He said, talk about his domination with Sean Kemp on those Sonics teams in NBA Jam. And that is still my go-to team, by the way.
Yeah, they were good. It's been too long since I played NBA Jam. I really need to figure out a way to play it again, because I enjoyed it so much when I was 14 or whatever, and it is so yeah. I mean, it was always good to have one guy who could dunk and one guy who could shoot threes.
They're the perfect combo, and they play good defense as well with that one as well. And if worse comes to worse, and you really need some steals or whatever, you can throw Peyton in there as well. So they're just the best team for that. I mean, they're one that a lot of people go to the Hornets, or like in Chicago, everybody goes with the Bulls, and it's like they don't have Jordan to eat it, but they gave all of Jordan's stats to B.J. Armstrong, because B.J. Armstrong's way too good in that game,
right?
So it's okay. But no, this is always my go-to team, because you have the dunk and the three. So you have, you know, Sean Kemp goes up for a dunk, and then if everybody jumps, you'd pass it out to Detlef Schrempf, who just hits a three, and then, you know, I win again. So, because that's how that works. I think that's it. Is that all for our question? We had one more here. Rich Thomas asked another one here that I thought was pretty interesting as well. He said he went to high school in the U.S. It was only for his senior year, but he said, anyway, do you see Detlef Schrempf as a product of European basketball development or American development? So, Jason, what do you think on that one?
I would say American, just because, I mean, his European play was really, because he took it up when he was about 13.
Yeah.
So that was really only like 4 years, and I'm sure those were important, you know, influential years, and they mattered. But I just think he did so much more in the United States.
And as we mentioned too, the guy who discovered him in Germany was, you know, a former NBA player. So,
right.
You know, in a lot of ways, yeah, he it wasn't like they found this guy that had been, you know, like Dirk, you know, I'm not even going to pronounce his shooting coach guy, but like, you know, that guy was working with him as Hertzgerder, like Zertgerder or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that guy worked with him since he was like six. I mean, that's a guy who's clearly developed by Germany. Schrempf was a guy who was just doing whatever, and the NBA guy, you know, sees him and develops him. And then he comes here and has, you know, 4 years in Washington and 4 years in college in Washington, rather, is what I meant. But yeah, no, he seems like a guy of American development.
He did. And he played, of course, in some of the European tournaments, and he was involved in Europe as well. So, I mean, I think he's part, I mean, I guess he's a product of both, but if I had to choose, like, which one is he more of, I would say American.
Yeah. I agree. All right. I want to move on to another section here. You want me to talk advanced stats?
Absolutely.
Yeah, here, let's talk about a few things that I did, a little bit of play indexing here to look at. This actually ties in a little bit to a question. We had somebody who asked, who are some notable players in NBA history with similar stat lines? And this is from Andy Altnoff. And a few guys that I looked at, it's actually using total points, total rebounds, and total assists. Three guys that came up real close to exactly the same numbers that he had were, interestingly enough, and I, you know, looking at these guys, pretty close. Richard Hamilton, Rashard Lewis, and Bob Dandridge were the three that were as statistically as similar to him. What are your thoughts on those three? Anyone that kind of stands out as, you know, he's nowhere near him? They kind of work.
Yeah,
actually.
That's about right. I mean, Rashard Lewis is kind of an interesting.
He's definitely.
And I think if Detlef had played, if his career, had begun around the time that it had been on the same timeline as Lewis when he started and ended his career, or I guess he's still playing, but. I think probably Detlef would have been used in a similar way.
Sure. Yeah. He was a little bit before the stretch fours in that sense.
Yeah.
And Detlef, to his credit, was a way, you know, really good at backing guys down and really good in the post. So,
sure.
So I get that they wouldn't have just wanted to, you know, stick him out there, you know, for three, but he was a guy who could back out there and was super efficient from there too. So very, very interesting. But yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. Those three guys and how they were pretty similar there. A few other things I found out, so I looked at per 100 possessions, points, and rebounds. So Detlef is actually one of 26 guys to average over 23 points per 100 possessions and over 10 rebounds per 100 possessions. And there's only a few guys that are active and not Hall of Famers, or only non-active guys that are Hall of Famers. There's a bunch that are still active and, you know, are guys that are shoo-ins for the Hall of Fame, guys like LeBron and a few others. But only non-active guys that are not in the Hall of Fame. There's Shaq, who obviously is just, you know, waiting his time and will definitely be in there. Larry Nance, Rasheed Wallace, and then Schrempf. So it's only Nance, Schrempf, and Rasheed Wallace are really guys that are sort of on the fence. And Rasheed Wallace seems like a guy to me that will probably get in. Yeah, Nance, that's probably not going to happen. But Schrempf, again, comes up, and he's another guy we talked about. You know, does he deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? And you know, when you look at these numbers and the guys he's with, yeah, I mean, you could honestly make a case for that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Nance is a guy who's talked about as like, he's better than people like recall him being, and that probably boosts his case. You know, but probably Schrempf has that a little bit as well. So that one's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and then I looked at a few other stats here. I looked at this one's a little bit interesting of how I got here, but it kind of worked with me, and I can send a link if people have any curiosity about what I did. But what I did is I looked at Schrempf's total points, total rebounds, and total assists, and I basically looked at everybody that was better than him, everybody who had more, in these categories. So you basically, to be listed on this, this data set here, you have to have more total points, more total rebounds, and more total assists. And I didn't add those all together. They're sort of separate, but it kind of works in that way too. So basically, yeah, if you need the link, I can send it to you to kind of see what I did here. But I thought it was a really interesting list that we got here. 11 players all time have more of all three of those. Kareem, Wilt, Karl Malone, Oscar Robertson, Kevin Garnett, Charles Barkley, Larry Bird, Jason Kidd. As you notice, we're all pretty good players. John Havlicek, Scottie Pippen, and then Detlef. So that's very good company to be in.
Absolutely.
In terms of versatile guys there.
Yeah.
That's the who's who. And, you're going to get, a few guys like LeBron, who's going to obviously get in there once he accumulates a few more. But, I mean, that could be something where you kind of look at a guy who played for a while and, he just accumulated all those stats. But, hey, you have to play a while to get those, and you have to get playing time in all those years to get that. So
yeah.
I don't think that's something to just, think that that's completely worthless or completely irrelevant.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes we underrate playing a while a little bit. I mean, I understand, right, playing a while and you're not effective, that doesn't help. But, if you're still pretty good at, 37 and 38.
If people are going to – if the coach is going to play you and a team's going to pay you to be 37 and play, that's to your credit.
Yeah,
knock points off for being a guy who can still play when he's 37.
Yeah,
and play heavy minutes.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And then you were looking, I know you were looking a little at some of the top game scores that he had in
his
career.
Yeah, so we have game scores and career highs here. We have five game scores here. His number one game score was 33.3, and this was February 28th, 1992 versus Orlando. He had 34 points and shot 66% from the field, so pretty good game there. His number two one was November 8th, 1995 versus Denver, and that was 32.1 game score. That's a really good game as well, 35 points, 8 rebounds, 68% from the field. You're going to notice a theme here. Detlef likes February because his third game is February 16th, 1997 versus the Lakers. That's a 31.9 game score. Number four is February 13th, 1993 versus Milwaukee, and that's a 30.9 game score. And then December 8th, not February, Detlef, that's okay, but December 8th, 1992 versus Golden State, that's a 30.7. And another interesting as well, I looked at career high games, and it was very interesting that they all came in the same year.
Yeah.
His career high of points was 36 in December 8th, 1992, and that was the aforementioned game. Or no, I actually didn't mention that game prior.
Yeah, it was number five.
Oh, that was number five. Yeah. Okay. There it is. Yes. So that was his number five game score all time, was the 36 points. Rebounds, he had 23 February 11th, 1992 versus Orlando. And then assists, 14 December 10th, again, 1992 versus Sacramento. So very interesting that 1992 was all of his career highs. And then I wouldn't count 92 as his best year, though. No. We talked about 94, 95 as kind of sticking out, but 92 is a great year, too. So.
Because there was actually two separate seasons, because it's two of them happened the 93 one happened the 93, or two happened the 93 season.
Are they? Oh, 92. No, they're all 90, December, February, December.
No, it's, but they're same year. So it's the February one happened first, and then there was.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see.
He finished, his true shooting percentage, 58.58, is tied with Shaq at 38th overall in NBA history, which is kind of interesting. And then his win shares for 48 is 71st overall in NBA history. And he finished, with just some great 49% field goal percentage, 38.4 from three, 80% from free throw line. So, I mean, he was efficient, but he put up good totals too.
Yeah, and you mentioned a few things here. Tied with Shaq, 38th overall in true shooting percentage, which is not bad for him, and then 71st overall in win shares per 48. So that's a good. I mean, we're looking at a good career here. I think maybe, do we have to start the Detlef Schrempf for Hall of Fame?
Well, he's either a choker or he's a Hall of Famer, depending on what part of the podcast you listen to.
I'm reserving both of those domain names right now. Detlef is a choker.com is, I'm guessing, still, hopefully still. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, hopefully that's not dirty or something. Yeah. That's not good.
No, I got lucky there. And then Detlef for Hall of Fame. Let's do number four, right?
There you go.
Detlef,
that's cool. Yeah, that makes sense.
It is both available. So anybody who wants to... either help us do it or, or reserve both those and start the campaign. But no, definitely a really good career. And that's a guy who, I probably underrated before we did this as well, before we did kind of the research and looked at him all the time. I mean, he's a guy that I sort of, as you mentioned, just thought of as a, really good for a long time, but He's better than that. I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. And just such a likable guy too. You know, that helps, I guess. Because like kind of a lot of the other guys we've done these full length research shows on have kind of been, you know, temperamental to a certain extent. And I guess Shrimp had a little bit of that, but for the most part, you know, seemed like a guy who, you know, very amiable. So.
Yeah, he was, and reading his quotes and reading sort of the stories, he was a guy that was just going to be honest, pretty much. He wasn't a guy that sort of sugarcoated or anything like that. I mean, to an extent, we could kind of say the same for Rick Barry. But yeah, he's a guy who just kind of said, yeah, that's, you know, it is what it is. So
absolutely. All right. Well, so everyone, please check us out at the podiumgame.com. You can find all our podcasts there. We are also on iTunes on the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Podcast Network, along with some other terrific shows, including the Podium Game. And we're also on Twitter at Over and Back NBA. We have a Facebook page. Which is facebook.com/overandback. We have a Tumblr over and back. I think it's over and back NBA.tumblr.com. Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, over and back NBA.tumblr.com.
Not for good branding there. I don't know all the other ones. Yes. I don't remember what our Tumblr
is. You'll see links there. And
don't go to over and back, because that's a, I'm looking at it right now, and it's a very odd Tumblr. I'm trying to make a no so tutu for Cha's Halloween costume. She's 13, mind you, and is going as a draft. So,
well, there you go.
That is not us.
That is not us. Over and back NBA is important thing. So, so if you have anything you want to talk to us about, whether it's about this show or about any other show we've done, you can hit us up on Twitter, post a comment on the post at the Podium Game. We would love more reviews and ratings on iTunes. If you want to, you got to look for, well, you can, if you look for Over and Back NBA, you'll probably find the Hardwood Paroxysm Network, but we're under the Hardwood Paroxysm Network with the other Podium Game and podcast. So yeah, is there anything I'm forgetting, Rich? I feel like I'm forgetting something. Did I plug everything well?
Yeah, you got the Twitter, you got the Facebook, you got iTunes. We like reviews. Did you mention that?
Reviews. I did mention that. Yeah.
Yes. We'll do that.
We would like the reviews and ratings. We would like good ones, but if you have to leave a bad one, like one guy did, you know, then, I mean, you know, that's, it's your choice. You know, you're living your life. I understand. Rich, thanks again. I had a fun time chatting about Detlef with you, and I'm looking forward to the next time we do this.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Goodbye, everyone.